lament for the monks who had been killed or wounded in the raid. It turned out that of all the parts of Britain and Ireland that suffered from Viking raids, the English-speaking areas were hit the worst. Ultimately, all of the major Anglo-Saxon kingdoms were knocked off by the Vikings except for one, the Kingdom of Wessex in the southwest. So it was Wessex that benefited when the Anglo-Saxons were ultimately able to drive the Vikings out. Wessex ended up being the only game in town, the last kingdom standing, and they were able to create a unified English kingdom by building on the wreckage left behind by the Vikings. So ironically, the Vikings helped unify the English. The impact of the Vikings was quite different in the rest of Britain and in Ireland. They had comparatively little impact in Wales. This was because Wales was a relatively poor place at the time. There were fewer monasteries than there were elsewhere in Britain, and those monasteries contained fewer treasures. Instead, the Vikings concentrated their efforts in northern Britain and in Ireland. I'll talk about Ireland first, with the understanding that in places like the northern part of the Irish Sea, the distinction between Ireland and Scotland is not very meaningful. Irish monasteries were raided repeatedly in some cases, whether by the same band of marauders or by different ones, it is now impossible to tell. For example, around the year 800, the great monastery of Iona, which is now in Scotland, but was then really part of the Irish world, was raided 3 times in a single decade. And it's a sign of how wealthy Iona was that the raiders kept finding something to steal year after year. But it was not just island monasteries or monasteries right on the coasts that were attacked. Even monastic houses that were farther inland were not immune. In 832, Vikings sacked the monastic settlement at Armagh, which is more than 20 miles from the sea. Here I need to pause for a moment to say something about a great debate among historians over how important the impact of the Vikings actually was in the history of Ireland. The Vikings in Ireland have been the subject of what historians call revisionism, which is a fancy way of saying reinterpretation. Some revisionist historians of the Vikings have argued that the impact of Viking raids on Ireland was actually minimal, particularly in comparison with their impact in England. After all, these historians point out, raids on monasteries happened a lot in Ireland anyway. It's just that the offenders were usually other Irish people. That's right. The Irish often raided monasteries as part of their own internal disputes over property and prestige. So what did it matter if the people who were attacking you were Irish or Scandinavian? The reason we think the Viking raids were so bad, these scholars argue, is that we have been listening to the voices of monastic authors who wanted to emphasize attacks by pagans over attacks by their fellow Christians. It is possible, of course, to let the revisionist pendulum swing too far. Some scholars have been so keen to exonerate the Vikings of all crimes that they have been led into some absurdities. Small Irish Christian shrines, known as house shrines, which are often richly ornamented, have been found in Scandinavia. And there's a wonderful example of such a shrine that was probably reused as a jewelry box. On the bottom, there is a runic inscription that reads, "Ranvig owns this casket." The revisionists argue that these shrines got to Scandinavia as part of a peaceful diffusion of Christianity or some sort of legitimate trading activity. Possibly. Maybe a nice Viking bought it for his wife and brought it home as a souvenir? But I think we're safer in concluding that it was plundered. So give the Vikings their due, but don't turn them all into peace-loving men. They weren't. Still, if we don't take it to extremes, there is definitely something to this revisionist argument. We should keep Viking activity in perspective as just one more factor in a generally violent and unsettled scene, and in fact, we should pay just as much attention to the positive aspects of Irish-Scandinavian interaction, though in some cases, the upside of the Vikings is more apparent in retrospect than it was at the time. By the middle of the 9th century, Vikings were beginning to settle along the Irish coast, and they created the nucleus of many of the most important towns in Ireland, including Limerick, Cork, Waterford, Wexford, and crucially, the future Irish capital, Dublin. Ireland really owes its first major effort at urbanization to Scandinavian raiders. These settlers added to the economic strength and cultural diversity of Ireland. For example, the Vikings brought a huge infusion of cash in the form of silver, much of which had been earned in trade or plunder from the Islamic world. The Irish word for market, marga, is borrowed from Old Norse, as is the word for penny, pingin, a pretty clear sign that the Irish associated the Vikings not just with violence, but with peaceful economic exchange. The Vikings also brought their sophisticated shipbuilding techniques and advanced metalworking skills to Ireland, and native craftsmen quickly adopted these techniques. Irish patrons were quite happy to purchase luxury products from Scandinavian traders. In fact, Irish art was profoundly affected by the Viking presence, to the point that by 1100 or so, the same churchmen who had earlier denounced the Vikings happily began commissioning works by Viking craftsmen, or at least by craftsmen influenced by Vikings. For example, there is the metal shrine made for the Kathach, the great Psalter, the Book of Psalms, of St. Columba. It was produced during the Viking period and clearly shows Viking motifs. So the Irish had no problem with using Viking art motifs to make a shrine for one of their holiest books. Around the same time, the abbots of Clonmacnoise, a great monastery in central Ireland, commissioned a crozier, a ceremonial staff, with very identifiably Scandinavian motifs on the head. The openness to outside influences that we saw in the high period of insular art continued through the Viking Age. The Vikings also profoundly changed metalwork in Ireland in another way. The dominant precious metal in Ireland had always been gold. Under the Vikings, there was a shift to silver because, as I said, the Vikings had contacts with the East, where silver is plentiful. You can't get it in Ireland. Silver coins were often made into arm rings that a warrior would wear as a mark of status. And the arm rings could be reused as a form of payment themselves because they were made to a standard weight. This shift from gold to silver is very apparent if you compare the Tara brooch, which was made in the 8th century, with the later Ross Cray brooch. The later brooch has much more done in silver rather than gold. This is the effect of the Vikings on jewelry making in Ireland. Of course, one of the areas where the Vikings clearly excelled was in warfare, and the Irish were, again, far from opposed to borrowing from their enemies. Perhaps the most important thing they borrowed from the Vikings was the battle axe, a fearsome weapon that could be used to literally chop your enemies to bits. The Irish seem to have taken to the battle axe with great enthusiasm, so much so that by the 12th century, Gerald of Wales, who came to Ireland in the wake of the English invasion, regarded the battle axe as the Irish weapon of choice. In fact, a contemporary manuscript of his book, The History and Topography of Ireland, shows the invading English soldiers with swords and the Irish with axes. Gerald was probably totally unaware that the axes were a recent import to Ireland. Yet another example of the Irish willingness to appropriate whatever they liked about the Vikings. And it wasn't all war, of course. This assimilation was taking place in personal relationships as well. There seem to have been numerous intermarriages. For example, a mid-10th century king of Dublin and York named Olaf Sigtryggsson married two different Irish princesses. And such marriages took place at all social levels. Those probably aided in the slow Christianization of the Viking settlements. Interestingly, the Irish made a note of this development. They saw that a group of people was appearing, the children of these inter-ethnic unions, who were neither exclusively Irish nor exclusively Scandinavian. And they came up with a word to describe these people. They called them the Galgael, which means the foreigner Irish. These Galgael had a foot in both cultural worlds. They were often bilingual in Irish and Norse, and they could function comfortably in the whole northern world that encompassed Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Scandinavia. They were the ancestors of a very important group of mercenaries in the later Middle Ages, who were brought into both Ireland and Scotland from the islands in the Irish Sea and western Scotland. They were known as the Galloglass, or foreign soldiers, which, if you know your Macbeth, is one of the kinds of soldiers that the fierce rebel MacDonald brought in to fight against King Duncan. But let's get back to the 10th century. As the Vikings increasingly converted to Christianity, the Irish kings felt more comfortable working with them and accepting them as clients. And we see the same openness to Viking interactions in the political realm as we do in the realms of art and commerce. Before long, the Viking settlements had effectively been slotted into the native Irish political hierarchy, where you see a few large dynasties competing for the allegiance of small client kingdoms. The Vikings were lucrative allies to recruit, not enemies to get rid of. Irish kings regarded the newcomers who had put down roots along their coastline as just one more element in a complicated local power struggle. And these kings decided how to react to the Vikings on a case-by-case basis. They fought against some groups of Vikings and allied with others in an effort to improve their own position vis-a-vis other Irish kings. The most important king to do so was Brian Boru, a southern Irish king who allied with Vikings to help defeat his Irish rivals. At the Great Battle of Clontarf in 1014, just north of the Viking city of Dublin, Brian and his Viking allies defeated another Irish king and his Viking allies. Ironically, this battle was later rebranded as a clash between the Irish and the Vikings, and a legend was born that stubbornly persists to this day, the notion that Brian Boru drove the Vikings out of Ireland. And in fact, this is what I learned as a very young student from some rather unsophisticated books of Irish history for children. But the story was spun this way a century after the battle by Brian's descendants, the O'Briens, in order to make their family look more impressive. The real story, I think, is far more interesting. The Vikings and the Irish coexisting in a kind of fruitful interchange. Surely not without tension, but not without advantages to both sides either. In order to understand what happened, we need to say a little bit about Irish politics in the 10th and early 11th centuries. Up until this time, Ireland had enjoyed a more or less stable system. And I do mean more or less stable, where both the northern half and the southern half of Ireland were each dominated by one major dynasty. This system began to break down in the early 10th century. One of the results of this upheaval was the rise of a new dynasty in Munster in the southwest that would end up replacing the dominant power there. This, of course, was Brian Boru. Brian is obviously one of the most famous figures in Irish history. He was called the Lion of Ireland, and there is a popular historical novel about him by the same title, which I quite enjoyed. Brian established his headquarters at Kinkora in what is now County Clare. But Brian was not content merely with being a provincial king. He aspired to more. And you can see if you plot on a map his various campaigns during the course of his very long reign, he starts out basically confined to the south. But then he is increasingly able to move out of his own region and travel through the whole island of Ireland at will. It took tremendous energy to be on the move so constantly in an age when travel was difficult, but it was essential in an Irish ruler because you really had to show up in person if you wanted anyone to pay attention to what you said. How did he do it? Well, he must have had extraordinary energy. All successful medieval kings had to have this, but it was a necessary, not sufficient condition. You had to have more going for you than that. First, Brian was able to take advantage of divisions within the other Irish kingdoms. This was not a rare state of affairs, it must be said. Irish politics were complicated and fractious at the best of times. Second, Brian proved to be very adept at using the Norse settlements. He forged helpful alliances with the Norse of Limerick. Limerick was not far from Kinkora, as well as with the Norse of Waterford and Cork, and even occasionally with Dublin. his Norse allies often held the balance of power in his favor. Third, he was very good at public relations. He knew that having the church on his side would be a big help, so he made a very large donation to St. Patrick's Church at Armagh. He installed many of his own family members at the head of important churches in Munster, and he thus had the major secular and religious powers in Ireland on his side. But Brian's success rested on a pretty shaky institutional foundation. Or rather, it had no institutional foundation at all. It depended largely on his own energy, and that inevitably began to fail. In the year 1012, cracks began to appear in Brian's dominance. The northern half of Ireland had never been as securely under his control as the south, and in that year, some northern leaders took the field against him. His ally, the King of Meath, who was still dominant in the east, fell out with the Dublin Norse, and by the following year, Brian was forced to blockade Dublin in support. The siege lasted over the winter. The Norse in Dublin knew that the attack would be renewed in the spring, so they called in their allies from the Isles, the islands around Britain, including the Orkneys and the Isle of Man. The men of Leinster, who had been chafing under Brian's overlordship for almost two decades, also got ready to move. Brian called on his supposed allies in the north and the west, but they failed to turn out. His support in those regions was indeed shallow. To make matters worse, right before the imminent battle, Brian quarreled with the King of Meath, so he was relatively isolated, except for a contingent of supporters from the Norse community in Limerick. Thus, he went into battle on Good Friday, April 23rd, 1014. The battle lasted all day. Eventually, Brian's side routed the Leinstermen and the Dublin Norse, but Brian, who was too old and infirm to fight himself, was killed in his tent by Norsemen who were retreating in panic. The King of Leinster was also killed, though the King of the Dublin Norse managed to preserve himself by staying out of the battle completely. After his death, Brian was taken north to Armagh and buried there with elaborate ceremonial, as befitted a High King of Ireland, and his resting place is still marked in Armagh Cathedral today. So why does this battle matter? By itself, it did not end the Viking presence in Ireland. The Norse communities persisted for centuries thereafter, and the end of active raiding around this time had much less to do with Clontarf than with the conversion of Scandinavians back home to Christianity. After about the year 1000, the Vikings mostly stopped going a Viking and stayed home. So it's not about the Irish versus the Vikings. In fact, the two sides had been coming together for a century or so, as we have seen. The end of the Viking story in Ireland is a bit less glorious. For two centuries after the Battle of Clontarf, the Norse settlements maintained their distinctive identity, and the city of Dublin in particular was very important politically. But the Dublin Norse were less and less able to maintain their independence and more likely to fall under the overlordship of one or another of the Irish provincial kings. When the English invaded in the 1160s and 70s, they seized control of the Viking towns, and the Norse element there was swamped by the new English settlers. Still, the legacy of the Vikings in Ireland survives in the Irish cities and, as science is now showing, in the Irish people. I have a friend whose ancestry is supposedly 100% from County Cork in southwest Ireland, but her genetic profile contains a significant percentage of Scandinavian ancestry. Many personal names that now seem to us quintessentially Irish are actually Scandinavian in origin, such as Doyle, which means son of the dark foreigner, or McAuliffe, which means son of Olaf. So the Viking influence on Ireland needs to be uncovered, but it's certainly there. I want to turn now to Scotland, where the story was somewhat different. Here, the Norse maintained a separate identity for far longer than they did in Ireland. The Vikings settled more extensively in parts of western and northern mainland Scotland and in the islands around Scotland, both to the west and to the north. And there was no English conquest of Scotland to erase their cultural presence. Thus, Scotland was much more diverse, both ethnically and linguistically, than Ireland was. Scotland, of course, had always been diverse. You may remember that in the early Middle Ages, many languages were spoken there simultaneously, not all of which were Celtic. But now the Norse language was added to the mix. We have less information about the early years of Norse activity in Scotland because there are fewer records that survive. But settlement seems to have begun with the Northern Isles of Scotland, the Shetlands and Orkneys, at some point around the late 8th century. The indigenous inhabitants of these islands probably spoke Pictish at the time, but Scandinavian influences quickly prevailed. The Norse influence on Scotland was very long-lasting indeed. The Northern Islands of Scotland were culturally Norse rather than Gaelic. In fact, a local variant of the Norse language known as Norn was spoken in those islands down to the 18th century. The height of the Scandinavian advance probably occurred in the middle of the 11th century with the career of the formidable Thorfinn Sigurdsson, Earl of Orkney. Thorfinn was able to extend Scandinavian rule onto the mainland of Scotland in the far north, and that is still the part of the mainland with the highest concentration of Norse place names, such as Sutherland, Wick, and Dingwall. Thorfinn is an interesting character, and it would be nice to know much more about him. He is the subject of a saga in Old Norse, which is a good sign of how important Scotland was to the large Scandinavian cultural realm. Although many details of Thorfinn's life are uncertain, he was clearly a classic example of the kind of cultural hybridity that we find in this area. His father was a Scandinavian earl named Sigurd, who died at the Battle of Clontarf in 1014. But his mother was the daughter of a Scottish ruler, possibly King Malcolm II of Scotland, though other candidates have been proposed. This means he was undoubtedly bilingual in Norse and Gaelic. In fact, Thorfinn is such an ambivalent figure that some scholars have even proposed that Thorfinn is actually identical with the character we know of as Macbeth, and this is the premise of a brilliant historical novel by Dorothy Dunnett called King Hereafter. I am not persuaded, much as I love the novel, but the fact that this hypothesis could gain any traction at all is a good sign of how intermingled the Celtic-speaking and Norse-speaking worlds were at this period. I will talk more about the historical Macbeth in another lecture. Vikings also settled in Western Isles of Scotland and the Isle of Man and created a multi-ethnic, multilingual Kingdom of the Isles. And the later Lords of the Isles, who were largely autonomous, were not finally subdued by the Scottish crown until the end of the 15th century. Many of the clans of the Western Isles, including Clan MacLeod, trace their ancestry back to Norse rulers. I want to talk about one final area in more detail, because I think it perfectly exemplifies the cultural fluidity of the Irish Sea region, and that is one specific component of the Kingdom of the Isles, namely the Isle of Man, which is right in the middle of the Irish Sea, about equidistant from Ireland, northern England, and southern Scotland. The origin of the name is a bit mysterious, but it could refer to a Celtic word for mountain, or it could also be a reference to the Celtic god of the sea, Manannán MacLir. The Isle of Man was really a melting pot where all of the diverse influences in what historians now like to call the Irish Sea world all came together, and it's easy to see why this should be so when you look at its location and also hear a brief rundown of the different regimes that have ruled the Isle of Man over the past millennium and a half. The earliest inhabitants of Man that we know of were probably Britonic speakers, that is, they spoke the pre-Celtic language of Britain. At some point in the 6th century, Man was probably occupied by people from the north of Ireland, and there may even have been a brief interlude in the 7th century when the English-speaking people of the Kingdom of Northumbria seized control of the island. Thereafter, though, the main contest was between Irish and Scandinavian influence. In the 10th and 11th centuries, the island was ruled first by the Viking kings of Dublin and then by the Viking earls of Orkney, so first Irish Vikings and then Scottish Vikings, if you will. But the population was primarily Gaelic in culture and language. During this period, the language of Man became more distinct from Irish until it developed into the Goidelic or Q-Celtic language we know today as Manx. A watershed moment for the Isle of Man came in 1079 when the Crovan dynasty established itself on the island. Although the Crovan kings were nominally subject to the kings of Norway, it was not until the 13th century that the Norse kings were powerful enough to try to assert their dominance. And by that point, the increasingly powerful Kingdom of Scotland was interested in cracking down on Norse influence on its western periphery. In the 1260s, Scotland and Norway fought a war, partly over control of Man, and Scotland emerged victorious. However, the victory was short-lived. The English and the Scots traded control of Man over the next century or so, and the Scottish king David II, who was captured by the English in 1346 at the Battle of Neville's Cross, was actually forced to bargain away the Isle of Man when he couldn't pay his ransom. With a few hiccups along the way, England has ruled Man ever since, but it has a strange constitutional position. Man is not subject to the British Parliament. It is autonomous within the United Kingdom, and it coins its own money and prints its own postage stamps. In fact, it makes a lot of money on stamp collectors. The Manx language, alas, is largely extinct, though there are efforts underway to revive it. Of course, we can't leave this discussion without touching on a topic that probably most people think of first when they think of the Isle of Man, and that is the famous Manx cat. Manx cats have no real tails. The taillessness is caused by a genetic mutation that seems to have arisen independently on the Isle of Man. There are all sorts of legends about the cats, including one in which the cats arrived on a ship of the Spanish Armada that was wrecked, and the cats swam ashore. Not very likely. But interestingly, sort of like there is with the Irish Book of Invasions, there is a grain of truth to the Spanish connection with the Manx cats, in that the cats of the Isle of Man turn out to be descended from the Spanish wildcat, rather than the common European wildcat, which is where the other cats of Britain and Ireland come from. So maybe the first cats came with the sons of Mele. We end with the Isle of Man because it is right at the center of the Irish Sea world, and because it perfectly encapsulates the kind of interplay of cultures that makes this region so fascinating. The Celtic-speaking peoples were always open to outside influences, and for many years they existed in close contact with Scandinavian peoples. Some of these encounters were violent, but many were fruitful, and they have left a lasting legacy in the landscape and people of this fascinating region.
Lecture 17, English Invasions of Wales and Ireland.
Welcome back. In this lecture, I'll tell the story of two efforts by the English to conquer Celtic-speaking countries, Wales and Ireland. I'll spend more time on Ireland in this lecture, but in order to set the scene for the Irish invasion, we need to start off with the Welsh one. But have no fear, the Welsh will get a whole lecture of their own. Let's start with a very quick overview of relations between the Welsh and the English from the period after the Anglo-Saxon settlements in the 5th and 6th centuries down through the 12th century. As I explained in my lecture on Britain after the end of Roman rule, the Anglo-Saxons advanced from east to west across Britain, but they were stopped short in the West Midlands at what we now know as the boundary with Wales. Over the next few hundred years, the Welsh princes continually raided the English and were raided in turn, but they sometimes allied with one English ruler against another. For example, the famous King Oswald of Northumbria, who was later revered as a saint, was killed in a battle against his English enemy, the pagan King of Mercia, and Mercia's Welsh allies. But the Welsh did not maintain this alliance with Mercia. During the 8th century, the military threat from Wales was great enough that the Mercian King Offa built a huge dike to try to prevent Welsh attacks. Substantial portions of this dike can still be seen today as a testament to the healthy respect that the English had for the fighting prowess of the Welsh. The dike helped to preserve the status quo between the Welsh and the English for many centuries, partly helped by the fact that Wales was almost always divided among rival rulers. But the relationship became strained during the reign of the next-to-last Anglo-Saxon king, Edward the Confessor. In 1055, a powerful Welsh ruler named Griffith ap Llywelyn managed to bring all of Wales under his command by methods that were not exactly gentle. Griffith then struck an alliance with a disgruntled former English earl and helped him to raid the English border town of Hereford. It took the English royal forces several campaigns to subdue Griffith, but King Edward's right-hand man, Harold Godwinson, managed to drive him into the far northwest of Wales, where he was ultimately killed. We think, it's not totally clear, by one of his Welsh rivals in 1064. Griffith's death had far-reaching implications. Once he passed from the scene, Wales immediately fell apart into its traditional smaller units, and this meant that 2 years later, when Harold Godwinson, now king, was defeated by William the Conqueror at the Battle of Hastings, Wales was going to meet the new threat, not with a single strong king, but with many weak ones. Despite this political disadvantage for the Welsh, William never fully conquered Wales, partly because he had a lot of other lands to worry about. In fact, much of the campaigning in Wales was actually done not by the kings of England, but by their lords, who were mostly interested in carving out estates for themselves that were as far as possible from royal supervision. Over the next century or so, what we see is more of an ebb and flow of Anglo-Norman incursions into Wales, first in the north, and then more successfully in the south. But they were always rolled back the next time a truly powerful Welsh ruler presented himself. This fluid frontier in Wales gave rise to a kind of hybrid society that took a little bit from both the Welsh and the Anglo-Norman sides, and there was plenty of intermarriage. These border areas were known as the Marches of Wales. A march is just a border area. It's where we get the word marquis or margrave from. The Welsh Marches could be a rather wild place, since people from both the Welsh and the English areas sometimes disappeared into the marches to escape the notice of their enemies. English kings were always a bit worried about the possibility of rebellions coming out of the marches, but it was a lot cheaper and easier to have their noblemen try to keep order and prevent the Welsh from causing trouble than it was to do it themselves. This very fluid Welsh situation played a huge role in the English invasion of Ireland. So let's turn to that now. In my lecture on the Irish Sea World, I mentioned that by the middle of the 12th century, the Irish political landscape had crystallized somewhat in comparison to an earlier period when Ireland was ruled by a large number of regional kings. By the mid-12th century, the number of important rulers in Ireland had been whittled down to maybe four or five at a time. So that was actually a lot of progress. England had also started out divided among many small kingdoms, but by the 12th century, it was incomparably more unified and more powerful than Ireland. The kings of England controlled most of western France, and, as we've seen, a significant portion of Wales. When King Henry II took the throne in 1154, there was talk of him invading Ireland as well, to kind of round out his portfolio. But there had been a long civil war before he became king, so he decided to concentrate on repairing that damage rather than on new conquests. But in 1155, the Pope, Adrian IV, issued the bull Laudabiliter, which gave the English king the authority to invade Ireland for the purposes of reforming the church. The reason was that the church in Ireland was not exactly conforming to modern standards of discipline and morality. Now, lots of people will point gleefully to the fact that this pope, the one who gave England a free pass to invade Ireland, was the only Englishman ever to sit on the throne of St. Peter. But the bull did not result in an immediate invasion because, as I said, Ireland was not a priority. So the bull just sat there. Now back to some Irish politics. Those four or five major rulers I talked about a moment ago tended to fall into two opposing alliances. In the 1160s, these alliances consisted of the King of Ulster and the King of Leinster on one side, and the King of Connacht and the King of Breffni on the other. But in 1166, the King of Ulster was killed. This was bad news for the King of Leinster, Diarmaid MacMurrough, because he was now out of allies. And apparently, he had worked hard at making enemies. One factor may have been a very personal dispute. In 1152, Diarmaid had kidnapped the wife of the King of Breffni, Tigernan O'Rourke, a close ally of Rory O'Connor, King of Connacht, the most powerful ruler in Ireland. Now, it turns out that Tigernan's wife, whose name was Dervorgil, sort of wanted to be kidnapped. I guess Tigernan had been mistreating her. So sources say that she conspired with Diarmaid to allow the kidnapping to happen. Still, this was a terrible insult to Tigernan. And to make matters worse, the very next year, Diarmaid seems to have gotten tired of Dervorgil and let her be recaptured on purpose. So this was a kind of double insult. First you steal my wife, then you don't think she's worth fighting to keep. So Tigernan hated Diarmaid with a passion ever afterwards. There were doubtless other strategic factors involved that are now lost to us. But this was the gossip that chroniclers reported, and it certainly does make a compelling story. In 1166, Tigernan finally got his chance for revenge. He used his influence with Rory O'Connor, King of Connacht, to force Diarmaid into exile. But Diarmaid was a stubborn man. He was about 57 years old at this point, but he was not ready to take defeat gracefully. On his way into exile, Diarmaid stopped off in Lismore in the south of Ireland, where he happened to meet up with a papal representative who mentioned to him this papal bull that had been gathering dust on a shelf for more than 10 years. So Diarmaid then left Ireland in search of Henry II of England, determined to use Laudabilitaire to get access to the English king, because he wanted Henry to help put him back on the throne of Leinster. Diarmaid tracked King Henry down in France, where he was campaigning, and asked for his help. In exchange, Diarmaid offered to become Henry's vassal. Henry was not interested in becoming personally involved in this matter, but he did give Diarmaid permission to see if any of Henry's vassals would be willing to help out. So Diarmaid finally wound up in Wales, which had some of the fiercest, most unruly Norman vassals around. This was the ideal place to recruit men for a desperate enterprise. And Diarmaid found one, Richard Fitzgilbert de Clare, Lord of Strigul, known to later generations as Strongbow. Diarmaid offered Strongbow his daughter Aoife in marriage and made him heir to the kingdom of Leinster if he would come to Ireland and help Diarmaid get Leinster back. Mind you, this would mean disinheriting Diarmaid's sons, but Diarmaid saw Strongbow as the best bet to get his kingdom back, so he staked everything on this Norman Welsh lord. Strongbow wasn't ready to move as fast as Diarmaid wanted him to, so Diarmaid enlisted some other allies, two half-brothers, Robert Fitzstephen, a Norman baron with close ties also to the Welsh aristocracy, and Robert's half-brother, Maurice Fitzgerald. These men became the ancestors of the famous Fitzgerald family in Ireland. They had the further distinction of being the uncles of Gerald of Wales, who later wrote a history of the invasion. The invasion unfolded in a series of expeditions. First a small group of Flemish mercenaries, then the Fitzgeralds, and finally Strongbow himself in 1170. And he brought the largest contingent of soldiers yet, 200 cavalry and 1,000 archers. Within 2 days, Waterford had fallen, and Strongbow finally married Diarmaid's daughter, Aoife, in Waterford Cathedral. This marriage between a foreign lord and an Irish princess was a powerful symbol of what the future held for Ireland. The wedding is the subject of a famous painting by Daniel Maclise, done in 1854, that now hangs in the National Gallery in Dublin. From this painting, you get a sense, I think, of the interpretation that was later placed on the event by 19th century Irish nationalists. it looks for all the world like an Irish version of the Rape of the Sabine Women. But the bad news for Strongbow was that King Henry was coming to check up on him. Besides wanting to rein in an unruly vassal, Henry has a second and perhaps even more decisive reason for coming to Ireland. He had a sudden, quite urgent need to look good in the eyes of the church. Why? Because of Henry's complicity in the crime of the century, the murder of Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury, in 1170. In the summer of 1171, Henry heard that papal commissioners were on their way to England to issue a condemnation for Becket's murder. It seemed like a good time to get out of town and to be seen to be doing the church's business while he was at it. So Henry invoked Laudabiliter at last and made plans to depart for Ireland with an even larger army than Strongbow had, plus siege equipment. Now, faced with an overwhelming force like this, Strongbow, of course, submitted. He accepted Henry's terms. Henry then called a church council. Lots of reforming legislation was passed. The bishops of Ireland accepted Henry as overlord. The Pope was gratified, and by September 1172, Henry was officially forgiven for Becket's murder, due in no small part to his Irish expedition. And the secular leaders of Ireland were pretty happy with Henry as well. The petty Irish king started submitting to him in droves to get grants of their lands. The problem was that Henry and the Irish kings had completely different ideas of what it meant to submit. Henry thought he was making grants of what was already his own property. Laudabiliter had given him rights in Ireland, after all. But the Irish kings only thought that the king was giving them protection against the seizure of their lands by the Norman lords already in Ireland. Henry was claiming more rights in Ireland than the Irish realized, and this fundamental clash would store up trouble for later. Now, if Henry had been able to stay in Ireland, perhaps he would have made good his conquest. Given his quite favorable reception by both church and lay lords, he might have created a unified Irish kingship at last. But as soon as Henry returned to his own lands, war broke out again between the English invaders and the Irish lords. A major problem was that when these two people tried to make treaties with each other, each side had a different conception of what they were agreeing to. And because the two societies had such different presuppositions about family inheritance and lordship, the Anglo-Normans practiced primogeniture, the strict rule that gave the bulk of the family estate to the eldest male heir, and the Irish did not. This caused tremendous problems. We've seen already that the Irish system was quite different. Really, the inheritance went to the person with the strongest party to back him. This was obviously a much more fluid, less reliable system than the Normans were used to. Furthermore, every time the inheritance changed hands, there was not necessarily the assumption that the relationships and agreements that the previous lord had entered into would be kept by the new one. So whereas Anglo-Norman lords were used to making a treaty with one man and then continuing it with his eldest son as a matter of course, the Irish assumed that you would need to negotiate everything all over again. And this drove the Anglo-Normans crazy, as you might imagine. They found the whole Irish political scene impenetrable, at least at first, and they had a very hard time getting their footing. King Henry decided that he would need to reorganize English rule in Ireland, and he decided to set up a lordship there for his youngest son, John, who had been born after all of the rest of Henry's vast landholdings had been promised to his older brothers. So John had been nicknamed John Lackland. So this scheme to set him up in Ireland was meant to address that situation. But when John actually went to Ireland in 1185, he made a total mess of the expedition. And the result was that Ireland remained divided among the Irish and the English in a kind of patchwork. There were areas where the English were quite dominant and others where they were very thin on the ground. But the expedition did produce something important to our story of the encounter between the Irish and the English, namely the first anti-Irish propaganda written by an Englishman, or, to be more precise, an Anglo-Welshman, namely Gerald of Wales, who accompanied John on his ill-fated visit to Ireland. Gerald is very interesting because he was himself very much of a cultural hybrid. He wrote about both Wales and Ireland and intended to write about Scotland as well, but he never got around to it. He wrote a reasonably sober account of the invasion, but he also wrote a book called The History and Topography of Ireland that was intended much more for the armchair traveler. It's full of stories about all the wonders you would encounter if you went to Ireland, from talking animals to sacred fires that never go out. Some of these stories are rather lurid. Gerald has an unhealthy obsession with bestiality, for example. But it's certainly arresting, and it was widely read. One of the most interesting aspects of the text is that you see already the genre of stereotyping the Irish and the Welsh as alien others for the benefit of an English audience. Gerald's stereotypes of the Irish would last almost down to the modern period. For example, here is Gerald on the Irish temperament. This seems to me a thing to be noticed, that just as the men of this country are, during this mortal life, more prone to anger and revenge than any other race, so in eternal death, the saints of this land, that have been elevated by their merits, are more vindictive than the saints of any other region. So, according to Gerald, even Irish holy men are more warlike than other saints. The stereotype of the fighting Irish is born in the 12th century. Now, I have read a lot of medieval saints' lives, and it's not true that Irish saints were meaner than other saints. There were angry saints to be found almost everywhere. Gerald was contemptuous of almost all aspects of Irish life, other than their music and art. He clearly thought Ireland was wasted on the Irish. Probably the most notorious passage in all of Gerald's writings about Ireland comes in the History and Topography, where he describes a supposed royal inauguration ritual that takes place in far-off Donegal in the northwest of Ireland. Now, Gerald has not been to Donegal, so he is reporting these details second-hand, if not third or fourth-hand. Gerald claims that in order to be inaugurated, the king of that region must copulate with a mare, after which act the mare is slaughtered, and then the king bathes in a broth made from the unfortunate horse. As you may well imagine, this vivid scene has drawn the prurient attention of readers for over 8 centuries. Let's return for a moment to John and his disastrous visit to Ireland. John had left in disgust, and he would not return to Ireland until 25 years later, in 1210, when he mainly came to punish his own rebellious barons. And after that, no English king returned to Ireland for nearly 200 years. Thus, Henry II's scheme for an Irish kingdom with perhaps a resident monarch came to naught. One of John's few visible achievements was his castle at Limerick, which remained in royal hands, and it has stood the test of time quite well. Another thing John did with very long-lasting implications was to start the process of dividing Ireland into counties. And today, the counties of Ireland are absolutely fundamental to Irish identity. Practically the first question you might ask an Irish person is what county they come from. So ironically, counties are an English import. Just another sign of how much the Celtic areas have been influenced by outside forces over the years. But once John withdrew, the Anglo-Norman settlers were left practically to their own devices to try to expand their holdings at the expense of the Irish. One important step that the settlers took was to construct a network of castles to help them to secure their lands against Irish attacks. These castles grew up somewhat haphazardly in places where the settlers felt able to build them, and they clearly clustered along the east coast. Castles were often initially very modest, but they could grow very large and impressive, as for example at Kilkenny Castle, begun in the late 12th century and then expanded. They also imported settlers from England and Wales in the hopes of recreating the kinds of estates and lordships that they were familiar with at home. What did the Irish make of all of this? Of course, the arrival of so many armed and determined English soldiers had effectively ended any hopes that the Irish would develop their own unified kingdom. Irish politics were not merely fractured. Due to the various encroachments of the Anglo-Norman lords, even provincial kingships vanished. And we must remember that the small lordships that remained among the Irish were still not really territorial entities, but rather networks of relationships, all of which were extremely fluid. At the top was the over-king and his family, any one of whom might be in rebellion against him at any given time. Underneath were the chiefs, some of whom were descended from formerly semi-autonomous minor kings. They controlled their own kinsmen and clients under them, and these were notoriously unreliable. It was always a matter of suspense whether they would turn out when summoned. Now, into these fluid networks, the Anglo-Norman lords, or even agents of the English crown, happily inserted themselves. Just as the Vikings had been absorbed into local Irish politics, these newcomers also made alliances with the Irish. And just as with the Vikings, the Irish did not have any scruples about using the newcomers to score points against their own Irish rivals. Now, why didn't the Irish simply band together to beat back the settlers? It seems that they were always too worried about their rivals making alliances with the settlers, so it made sense to make their own best deal with the newcomers before their enemies did. So why didn't this work out as well as it had with the Vikings, who, after all, were ultimately absorbed into Irish society? The problem was that the English had a very different attitude to grants of land. They were meant to be perpetual, and once you put castles on them, it was hard to get rid of them. So when the Irish thought they were making a clever alliance to meet the political contingencies of the moment, they were actually letting in men who would not be so easily contained or sent packing when they were no longer useful. As a result, the Anglo-Norman lords, who had sometimes been installed, in fact, with Irish backing, became often not tools of the Irish, but the dominant players in local politics. They actually took the place of the old over-kings. Of course, in theory, the Irish lords could appeal to the English king. The problem was that the Irish lords usually had even less luck than the settler lords in getting the English king to pay attention to them. So often, they were just stuck making the best deal they could with the settlers. Since the Anglo-Irish lords felt increasingly that they were on their own, they figured that if it was up to them to protect their own estates, they would use whatever method seemed best to them. Many times, this meant adapting to local conditions and adopting Irish forms of warfare and the use of Irish law, and of course, the use of the Irish language. We'll get back to that in a moment. First, I want to mention another big factor that can help to explain the dramatic changes in the balance of power in Ireland that helped the native Irish inhabitants and hurt the English colonists, the Black Death. The Black Death spread throughout Europe and reached Ireland in 1348, first in the southeast and then spreading to the north and west. But it was disproportionately severe in the towns, which is where the English lived. So the impact was much worse for the settlers than for the native Irish. You started, in fact, to see people giving up and moving back to England. By the late 14th century, there were laws passed trying to stop English settlers from returning, and also trying to force English settlers who had already moved back to England to go back to Ireland, because there simply weren't enough people of English blood to man the defenses of the colony. It must have seemed for a moment there as if the English problem in Ireland would take care of itself because the English would all leave. The kings of England were certainly aware of the problem. Ireland went from providing revenue to being a net drain on the English treasury. So in 1361, King Edward III had his son, Lionel, marry the heiress to the earldom of Ulster, and he sent Lionel to Ireland to rule on his behalf. Lionel did his best, but he was horrified by the degeneracy he found. The English settlers were acting like Irishmen. So he called a parliament at Kilkenny to try to address the problem. And this parliament produced the notorious Statutes of Kilkenny in 1366. It helps to know some background here of what was going on in the rest of the English world. For most of the 14th century, and then half of the 15th century, England was at war with France. And during these struggles with France, English national identity developed to a degree not seen before. Until then, French had been the language of the English court. It was the prestige language, the cultivated language. But now, English replaced French. Lines of ethnic identity were being increasingly sharply drawn. As a result, the English in Ireland grew very nervous about the ways in which some among them had begun to assimilate to the Irish way of life. So the statutes that were passed in 1366 were aimed not at the Irish. That is a common misconception about them. They were aimed at the English in Ireland to try to get them to stay English and not go completely native. They first of all ordered that the Anglo-Irish, that is, the people who had been settled in Ireland for generations, should not be treated any differently from Englishmen who had just arrived in the country. It's quite clear from this that such distinctions were in fact being drawn, and we even know what insults were being used by each side against the other. The Irish would call the newcomers English hob, and the English would call the Irish Irish dog. And this tended to drive a further wedge between the two segments of the English community. Then there's a whole list of Irish things the English aren't allowed to do. The Anglo-Irish were ordered to speak only English among themselves. The law thus recognized the necessity of speaking Irish when dealing with Irish neighbors, but they did not want any use of Irish when it wasn't strictly necessary for such a practical purpose. Along the same lines, the Anglo-Irish were not to use Irish names, either first names or Irish-style surnames. They were not supposed to ride horses in the Irish style, that is, bareback with no stirrups. They were not supposed to get Irish haircuts, which were shaved on top and long in the back, looking sort of like a mullet. And one of my favorites, the Anglo-Irish were not to have Irish musicians and storytellers perform in their halls, because everyone knew how much sheer Irishness these people managed to get across. There was thus supposed to be a cultural wall between Irish and English that would seal the two ethnic groups off from each other. However, some English settlers in Ireland became so enamored of Irish culture that they not only learned the Irish language, but even wrote poetry in Irish. In fact, the third Earl of Desmond, Gerald Fitzgerald, who was alive at the time of the statutes, wrote quite good Irish poetry. Now, since the statutes are aimed squarely at the Anglo-Irish, they can obscure the fact that acculturation was a two-way street. You could find some great hybrid names in 14th century Ireland among the Irish. These are actual people. Edmund O'Kennedy. Henry O'Neill. Now, you don't get much more English than Edmund, for goodness sake. The Irish also had no problem sending their children to settler families for fosterage. And notice that this very key Irish social institution is now uniting the two groups. The problem with the statutes was that they assumed that if you could change the language people spoke and the way they cut their hair, or didn't cut it, you would change the political realities on the ground. In fact, though, a lot of assimilation on the part of the Anglo-Irish was really an effort to survive in an increasingly precarious environment. One of the provisions of the statutes was that the Anglo-Irish should not use Irish law to settle disputes. But what were you supposed to do if you lived in an area where that was the only law available? The statutes were thus trying to legislate about hair and saddles and other such things, when the real problem was the lack of infrastructure that could support an English-style government. But it's a lot cheaper to ban Irish haircuts than to provide the resources to garrison the countryside. And it's important to keep in mind that however much the government wanted to make distinctions, there was no hard and fast line between English and Irish. Cultural assimilation did not always make the settlers forget who their ancestors were. But even within a single family, there were wide variations in practice. In 1371 to 1372, John, son of William Le Poer, went to jail under the statutes for knowing no English. He was released when an older family member promised he would learn. We notice then that there are bilingual family members, because obviously, if this guy John knows no English, he is speaking to the rest of his family in Irish. So where does that leave the Anglo-Irish? They think of themselves as English. Their political allegiance is English. but they look and act Irish, which makes the real English suspect their loyalty. They want more help from England, but they're often dissatisfied with the help that they are sent. They're in a very ambivalent situation, and it's not going to get any better until the Tudor government in the 16th century decides to resolve the